makes no sense in an age when the deadly poisons produced by a nuclear exchange would be carried by wind and water and soil and seed to the far corners of the globe and to generations yet unborn. For in the final analysis, our most basic common link is that we all inhabit this small planet. We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures. And we are all mortal.
David Talbot's new book, Brothers, is the story of the Kennedy presidency and two assassinations. The author takes us inside JFK's close circle of advisors, chief among them Bobby Kennedy, his brother and attorney general. And along the way, Mr. Talbot reveals the conflicts that pitted the Kennedys against the military and the national security agencies, which we just heard a speech regarding. And he considers the consequences of those conflicts. The book is published by Free Press, and it has brought David Talbot, the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon.com, to my show. Welcome.
Thank you, Leonard.
You were a volunteer for Bobby Kennedy during his presidential campaign. How old were you?
I was only 16 at the time. That was 1968 in California in the primary campaign.
Was that the beginning of political awareness for you?
Pretty much. My mother was very enthralled by the Kennedy glamour, and she got us excited. But, you know, even at that age, I was in a military school at the time. I knew kids who had gone from military school off to Vietnam. And even at that age, I saw Bobby as our last hope.
Do volunteers have any opportunity to come in contact with
no,
the man himself?
No. There was a film by Emilio Estevez that some of your listeners might have seen recently, Bobby. And, of course, it focuses on those volunteers at the Ambassador Hotel the last day of his life. But, no, I didn't get to do that myself.
Where were you where were you when he was shot?
Well, it's funny you should ask. I was in Laurel Canyon with friends listening to the radio, celebrating not his the shooting, but celebrating his victory. And we were smoking some marijuana and having
so
a good time.
So that movie was truer to,
exactly.
to life than some people suggested.
We were having a good time celebrating. And then, of course, the shock came immediately after that.
Did that influence your decision to go into journalism, do you think?
I think it did. I think we felt closed off politically from the American system, many people in my generation at that point. There seemed to be no way to move things forward, to stop this war. In some ways, it's like the situation we find ourselves in today with the political system out of sync with the American public's will. And we felt that very strongly as kids because, unlike today, we were being drafted also to fight in this war that we thought was a mess. So journalism seemed to be, particularly as I got out of college after Watergate, seemed to be the avenue to actually affect change.
Because of your personal experience, were you one of those people who read all of those Kennedy books over the years?
To tell you the truth, I avoided them for many years because it was so painful to me. It was just a sad journey. And so I didn't actually read them until later. I've been inspired to read them now. Well, not now, but in recent years, because out of a need to be reminded again of what we lost and what America could be.
Well, there have been three kinds of approaches to the Kennedy story. There's the Camelot books, the sex and scandal exposés, and the assassination conspiracy books. Did you think that something was missing from all of them?
Yes, I think I see my book Brothers as a part of a wave of a new wave of scholarship on this subject. It's not hagiography. It's not worshipful, and yet it's not scandal driven either. And I tried to avoid some of the same dark labyrinth that many people have disappeared into with conspiracy books.
Although this comes closer to conspiracy book, partly because Bobby believed there was a conspiracy.
Well, that's it. Bobby was, in fact, one of our, you could say Bobby was our first conspiracy theorist because he decided on the afternoon of November 22nd, 1963, that Lee Harvey Oswald was not the full story.
My guest is David Talbot, who's written a book called Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, published by Free Press. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. He decided right on that day. Most people just go into shock and then think about it sometime later.
Well, I think as Jack Newfield, the late Jack Newfield, who is such a close friend of Bobby Kennedy's, told me before he died, that he was lit up with the electricity of adrenaline that day. And with that computer-like brain of Bobby's, he put together what he thought was the outlines of the plot. And, of course, he could do that because Bobby was deeply immersed in the administration. He felt the tensions and the dark intrigue that was building within the Kennedy presidency himself, personally. He was in charge of, really, the dark side of the administration for his brother. He took care of the tougher tasks, from civil rights to organized crime to Cuba, which could have become the Iraq of its day. So that's why Bobby immediately began to go there in his mind right after Dallas.
Now, why have we not been more aware of this? Did he keep these thoughts to himself?
Absolutely. What he said in public was to endorse the Warren Report. And he did that pretty much throughout his life until he himself was killed in 1968. But he did that for political as well as personal reasons. But what he was telling his advisors, his closest advisors, secretly or privately, was that he was going to reopen the case if he made it back to the White House.
So one of the reasons you say he ran for president was to reopen the case, and because he rejected the Johnson, the
Warren Report.
The Warren Report.
That's right. Well, he wasn't even waiting till then. He was very quietly using surrogates, using private investigators, using journalists who were friends, advisors who were close to him, to pursue various leads. He went to Mexico City himself to look into the mysterious trip that Oswald made there before Dallas. He went back to the Justice Department after he'd been elected to the Senate from New York, after hours with Walter Sheridan, a former FBI agent who was helping him with the investigation, to look through files. He sent Sheridan to New Orleans when Jim Garrison was starting his prosecution there to see if Garrison had anything. So he was very much on the trail, looking into various leads, but particularly, Leonard, after that first week, that's when you can really see, in the hours and days right after the assassination, Bobby Kennedy at full bore looking into this crime.
But he may have been the only Kennedy who felt that way. The others aren't talking, and they shut out Frank Mankiewicz just because he took a job related to Oliver Stone's movie JFK.
Yes, the family has decided to follow, I think, unfortunately, Bobby's public pronouncement, which is, let's move forward, not look back. And you can understand, for emotional reasons, why Bobby's children and the second generation of Kennedys would take that tack. It's enormously painful for them to this day. They lost an uncle. They lost a father. It devastated that family emotionally. And it shouldn't be up to the family, frankly, to get at the bottom of this. That's the job of the judicial system and the political system in this country.
So did he think that questioning the single shooter idea would have destabilized the country? Is that why he was quiet?
That was one reason. He made a political decision, as I say, right after Dallas, to keep quiet publicly about it. One reason, I do believe, was he thought it would split the country. You know, there was a wonderful journal called Minority of One that was published by a survivor of Auschwitz, Menachem Arnone, who immediately after the assassination in his journal wrote just that. That he suspected that one reason LBJ, who probably knew more about the crime than he was letting on, and Bobby weren't saying anything publicly was they were worried that this would produce such civil strife that it could tear the country apart, even having American soldiers firing at other American soldiers. That was one reason. The other reason I think Bobby kept quiet was he had no power really to do anything. That was the main reason. You know, J. Edgar Hoover, head of the FBI, which was basically in charge of the investigation.
And Bobby hated you.
Hated each other. They were poisonous enemies. LBJ, of course, himself hated Bobby and vice versa. Bobby thought he was a usurper, that his brother should have been in that position, not LBJ. And if not his brother, he himself. So they had a mutual contempt for one another. Bobby felt his power slipping away minute by minute, right after the shots were fired in Dallas.
So you say that you talked to people who knew what he was really thinking. You also found some newly released government documents?
Yes. Well, I think these new documents that have come out over the years don't shed as much light particularly on the assassination as they do on the chemistry of the Kennedy administration. And that's a big part of my book, I should say. It's not just about Dallas. It's about the internal life of the Kennedy administration.
Which you depict as being a lot more peace-oriented than most people remember it to
be. Absolutely, and I'm so glad you began the show today with a clip from his famous peace speech, JFK's at American University in June 1963. Imagine those words being spoken by any American leader during the Cold War, or even today, during our war on terror, that we can actually empathize with our enemy and see them as human beings and live in the same world with them peacefully. That's a remarkably, I think, revolutionary message. So JFK was trying to, I think, lead the country out of the Cold War before the national security bureaucracy was ready for it. There were extremely volatile tensions between the White House and the Pentagon and the CIA. It started with the Bay of Pigs, of course, the failed CIA invasion of Cuba. They wanted Kennedy to go in right afterwards to rescue that invasion with a full military onslaught on Cuba. But he knew that it would get bogged down. We'd have an Iraq-like situation there, so he refused.
But hadn't Kennedy run for president as a Cold Warrior? After all, one of the big things he claimed that the Republicans had done was to allow for a missile gap, which turned out to not be true. But he kind of Cold Warred Richard Nixon in that campaign.
Yes, he did. And I think he paid for it later. I think he paid for it. And, of course, what he was trying to do was avoid being another Adlai Stevenson, a wimpy liberal intellectual who couldn't possibly get elected. We've seen a number of Democratic candidates get outmuscled that way over the years. But Jack Kennedy was a different kind of animal, and he was determined to win one way or the other. And I agree with you. I think he did go too far.
But even later, he greeted the survivors of the Bay of Pigs with a promise to fly the rebel flag over Cuba someday.
That's right. He got caught up in the euphoria of that, addressing that crowd. Cuba, again, very emotional issue. The Cuban prisoners had just been released by Castro. There they were at the Orange Bowl in Florida. And Jack Kennedy, who's usually a very cool customer, got caught up in the moment.
And then he didn't pull all the troops out of Vietnam. There's still a debate over whether he would have ended that war or not if he hadn't been assassinated. But it seems to me he's sending out mixed signals.
I don't agree about Vietnam, by the way. I think that there's enough scholarship now to show that he fully intended to withdraw all the troops after he was reelected in 1964. Again, he was a very shrewd political animal, and he knew that if he tried to withdraw from Vietnam before the election in 1964, that would be used as a club against him by Barry Goldwater and the Republicans. So, yes, what Jack Kennedy is trying to do, I think, is something very interesting. He's trying, on the one hand, to position himself — this is the height of the Cold War, let's not forget — as a muscular, aggressive foreign policy leader. On the other hand, what he's doing through back channels and through diplomacy with Khrushchev and Castro — even Castro at the end of his life, his arch enemy here — was to establish a diplomatic dialogue that would take us out of this very dangerous hair trigger situation.
And you're saying that it really angered all of the people who were part of the military-industrial complex, to
Absolutely.
Use Eisenhower's term.
Absolutely. These were people, in the case of, say, General Curtis LeMay, head of the Air Force, who wanted to have it out with the Soviet Union. They wanted a nuclear war.
Now, is this based on what his friends, Ted Sorensen and the like, told you, or is there any solid proof?
Well, this is based on over 150 interviews that I've done with former Kennedy administration officials and friends and colleagues. It's based on, as you said earlier, government documents that have been released over the last 20 years, particularly since the passage of the JFK Records Collection Act in 1992. We have a wealth of information now that's available to scholars because of that. So it's a variety of sources, but it's very clear. And it's oral histories that I've found by these generals, these people who admirals who were staunchly opposed to Kennedy's. I mean, LeMay at one point in an oral history that's at the LBJ Library, for instance, calls them cockroaches, the Kennedy people, who should be stepped on. They thought that Jack Kennedy was weak, inexperienced, that he was an appeaser, like his old man, Joe Kennedy, had been with the Nazis during World War II. They felt he was putting the country at risk. It's very clear from their own words and interviews and oral histories that these hardliners in the CIA and the Pentagon did over the years. That's the way they felt about JFK.
David Talbot is the founder and former editor-in-chief of Salon. He has also worked as a senior editor for Mother Jones, a features editor for the San Francisco Examiner, and has written for The New Yorker, Rolling Stone, and other publications. And he's written a book called Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, published by Free Press. We will continue our conversation after this.
Years ago, I introduced myself in Paris by saying that I was the man who had accompanied Mrs. Kennedy to Paris. I'm getting that same sensation as I travel around Texas. Nobody wonders what Lyndon and I wear.
John F. Kennedy speaking on the morning of November 22nd, 1963, just hours before he was killed in Dallas. And our thanks to Andy Lancet, the WMIC archivist, for providing that and the other clips that we've been playing today. As part of my discussion with David Talbot about his book, Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, published by Free Press. You say the first call that Bobby made after he heard the news that JFK had been killed was to Kenny O'Donnell. Now, who was Kenny O'Donnell?
Kenny O'Donnell was a part of the what was called the Irish Mafia, these very loyal political Pauls who had been with the Kennedys through the years. He was the chief of staff in the White House, and he was riding 10 feet behind the president's limousine in Dallas that day. He was a World War II veteran. He knew gunfire. He saw where the shots came from, and he reported back to Bobby that the gunfire had come both from the front, the so-called infamous Grassy Knoll area, as well as from behind, the Texas Book Depository.
And you spoke to him as well, right?
No, Kenny O'Donnell died a young man. He basically drank himself to death, had a very sad life after the Kennedys were killed. One old Boston politician at his funeral said, without the Kennedys, Kenny O'Donnell was the music without the harp. But I interviewed Kenny's son, Kenny O'Donnell Jr., and that's where I was able to get that information.
You also say he called the CIA.
He did. Bobby called a number of people on November 22nd from his home, Hickory Hill in Virginia. He called the CIA. He
spoke to John McCone.
He spoke at first to an anonymous CIA official, we don't know who, and said, did your outfit have anything to do with this horror? In a voice vibrating, apparently, with fury and pain. Later, he called the director of the CIA, John McCone, over to his home, and he spent the rest of the afternoon there. McCone assured him that the CIA had not been involved, but McCone himself believed there were two shooters that day in Dallas, not just one. And Bobby Kennedy later realized that he was talking to the wrong person because John McCone was not in control of his own agency.
Because he hadn't had a real background in intelligence, and so he wasn't really respected by the other people in the agency?
That's right. He was a political appointment. He was a Republican businessman who knew very little about the inner workings of the agency.
Well, many other people have suggested that it might, the mob might have been involved because he sure had done a lot to go after the mob.
Absolutely. Well, you know, there's been a debate through the ages, CIA, mafia, who did this. Bobby didn't separate the two. Bobby's political career began back in the 1950s, going after organized crime, the corruption of darker forces at work within the American political system and the corporate world and unions. So Bobby was horrified to find out when he was Attorney General that the CIA had banded together with the mafia in an attempt to assassinate Fidel Castro. He knew these two organizations were already working together.
But his own father had been connected to the mob.
Absolutely.
His father had been a bootlegger.
He had, and that's where much of the family's wealth came from. I think Bobby was attempting to somehow clean the stain from the family name in being so fervid about the way he went after organized crime. But in any case, that day, November 22nd, he immediately links the CIA and the mafia in his mind, and he thinks that the plot against his brother has come out of this shadowy war against Castro.
He said that the mob was a greater threat to the country than communism.
That's right. J. Edgar Hoover, of course, at the FBI, was still chasing communists. And Bobby Kennedy said, you know, there's more FBI undercover agents in the Communist Party in the U.S. than there are actual communists. So he knew that was a paper tiger, the Communist Party. Where he was focused on was the growing power of organized crime.
I get the feeling that JFK was much more willing to compromise to get his political ends than Bobby was. Bobby could be a little more reckless, or at least at this time was a bit more reckless.
Yeah, Haynes Johnson, the Washington journalist who knew them both, called Jack an English lord. He was smooth. He was sophisticated. He was more measured. Bobby was more an Irish priest or an Irish cop in Haynes's description. He was a hothead. He saw things in black and white. He was a true believer. I think that became tempered over time. He became a much deeper man.
Bobby had written a book about prosecuting the mafia called The Enemy Within, and it had been optioned as a movie. Both Bud Schulberg and Paul Newman involved in the production, but it was never made. Why?
Well, because of the influence of organized crime.
Wasn't a dead horse in a bed or
something? There might have been. There was... Because the Hollywood studio that was set to do it did pull out at the last minute. And this was probably the influence of the organized crime and the unions in Hollywood.
Because the mob played a major role in Hollywood at that time.
Absolutely. And there was a well-known actor who was set to go. Some people think it was Paul Newman, who also, I think, got cold feet at the last minute.
You report that Bobby called his closest associate in the Cuban exile community, Enrique Harry Ruiz Williams, after JFK was killed. Did he accuse him of being involved?
Another important call he makes, and that's what I try to create the drama of this, the first day as Bobby's trying to piece this together. He calls Harry Ruiz Williams, who is his closest ally in the Cuban exile community, and says, one of your guys did it. Now, again...
Because of the Bay of Pigs?
The age-old debate... Why? Well, yes, the Cuban exiles were very upset with the Kennedys because of the Bay of Pigs. They thought they'd been stabbed in the back. But why did Bobby say this to Harry Ruiz Williams? What did he mean? And what I suspect is he knew the name Oswald by then, and the CIA was already trying to, and the FBI, link Oswald to the communists as a pro-Castro agent and so forth. But Bobby rejected that immediately. What he's thinking at that point is Oswald is one of my guys. He's one of Harry's guys. And when he says to Harry, one of your guys did it, he's essentially saying it's one of our guys.
Because there had been death threats when JFK had traveled to Florida in 1963. From Cuban exiles.
Absolutely. Bobby was fully aware of that. In fact, he had been meeting secretly with informers in the Cuban exile world. I interviewed one, a man named Angelo Mercado, a Bay of Pigs veteran, who warned Bobby that there was dangerous talk about the president in these circles. They even tracked Oswald to New Orleans, these informers for Bobby, and reported back to Bobby that their strange gringo named Oswald was up to something, and they didn't know exactly what, but he seemed odd to them.
So they didn't reject the idea that Oswald had been one of the shooters. They just weren't sure whether he was the only shooter?
That's right. I think Bobby thought that Oswald was involved in some way in the plot, but that he was involved, he had an intelligence role of some sort, but that he wasn't the complete story.
They're also, as I understand it, the Democrats decided not to have Miami as the site of the 64 Democratic Convention because they feared for JFK's life.
That's right. Again, the Kennedy presidency is a beleaguered presidency. That's what my book really details in a way I think no other biography or history book
has. Because we remember it as kind of a Camelot, a happy time, and then
it was more Rome,
came an assassination.
It was more Rome on the Potomac than it was Camelot, Leonard. It was full of dark intrigue, violent kind of forces at work. You talk about Bobby wanting to get a film version made of his book on organized crime. Jack Kennedy also knew the power of Hollywood, and he felt so beleaguered that during his presidency, he goes to liberal friends in Hollywood and says, make a film version of 7 Days in May, the political bestseller about a military coup that nearly topples an American president. Because he was so concerned about the mutinous feelings within the military.
Well, their father had actually made films in Hollywood.
Absolutely.
Had a relationship with Gloria Swanson.
That's right. They knew the power of Hollywood. They knew the glamour of Hollywood. But I think he went to Frankenheimer and Kirk Douglas and others who did make that film because he was genuinely concerned about how disgruntled his own military was.
David Talbot is the author of Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, published by Free Press. So what about the administration's relationship with Cuba? You say that they were anti-Castro but didn't believe that Castro had anything to do with this. Why wouldn't they think that he might not have been behind this whole thing?
Well, for one reason, they were talking peace with Castro secretly. They were using an ABC newswoman named Lisa Howard, a very glamorous woman, ahead of her time before Barbara Walters, who was actually one of the first people to interview Castro for ABC and became Castro's mistress. She was shuttling back and forth between New York and Washington and Havana, along with a UN diplomat named William Atwood. Both of them established this channel for the Kennedys in which they were starting to broach the subject of peace.
Now, we've heard a lot about how Nixon went outside of the normal processes of Washington to get things done. You say the Kennedys did as well. They went outside the bureaucratic channels in an attempt to control the government.
Absolutely. The Kennedys were determined to get control of every arm of their government, and they failed. But they were willing to go outside the normal bureaucratic channels, which they felt were clogged and too conservative. An example is that 1961, there's a conference of Latin American financial ministers in Uruguay. Che Guevara, who, of course, the revolutionary, charismatic figure from Cuba, is at that conference, and he begins to stalk Richard Goodwin, the White House aide and speechwriter, who's young and liberal himself. He sees, Goodwin as an example of this new, fresh, young Kennedy spirit. And he finds him at a party in Montevideo one night, and they sit down and they talk all night about how Cuba and the United States can put the Bay of Pigs and their storied hostilities behind them and have peace. Well, when this leaks out back in Washington, of course, the conservatives go crazy, but Jack Kennedy takes it all in stride. He was willing to do things that were out of the ordinary like that because he did know that the system was clogged and couldn't be moved forward unless you did something dramatic like that.
So Bobby starts doing his own personal investigation into the assassination of his brother, and then he stops?
Yes. He has a burst of energy in the days and a week after the assassination. He even sends a friend, a close friend of the family, William Walton, to Moscow a week after the assassination to tell them, we know that you weren't behind the murder of my brother. It was a domestic political conspiracy. That's a remarkable thing for the Attorney General of the United States to do, sending a secret message to our archenemy at the height of the Cold War.
But it also suggests he'd come to a conclusion about it. I would have thought that he would have just run up against a bunch of dead ends and realized that he wasn't going to be able to find the answer, at least immediately.
Well, but Bobby couldn't help himself. He was on fire to get at the truth in those initial days after the assassination. But then, as you say, as time went on, he realized he couldn't solve the crime because he didn't have the power of the American of the federal government behind him. He did then sink into deep despair. He becomes a hollow man. He starts wearing his brother's old bomber jacket, and he shrinks inside of it because he's losing so much weight. He's in such terrible pain. That goes on for weeks and months. Even when he runs for Senate in 1964, he almost loses because he's stumbling through the campaign lost in a fog of grief. Finally, a friend comes to him, one of his toughest political aides, Paul Corbin, says, God damn it, Bobby, get a hold of yourself. You know, you're alive, your brother's dead, you know, be Bobby Kennedy. And he finally comes to life enough to win that campaign. But even after that, he suffered for, he suffered the rest of his life. But he finally begins to see that the only way to revive his brother's legacy, to complete his brother's mission, is to run for president himself.
But he never talks about the conspiracy or what he had discovered in his investigations.
Well, he does finally, actually, in a very curious moment. There's a rally on campus out in Southern California during this campaign where I was a volunteer. I wasn't there that day, but I've heard a radio broadcast from there. It was spring of 1968 at San Fernando Valley State College, where students begin to heckle him. And they say, we want to know who killed your brother. When will you open the archives, meaning when will the files, the Warren Report files, be open? When will people see the evidence? And Bobby says in a kind of irritable voice, your manners overwhelm me, he says. But he always had a very interesting relationship with students. He knew that Gene McCarthy, his Democratic opponent, had won them over before he could get in the race. He was very anxious to speak honestly with students. We remember the credibility gap. In that period, when young people didn't believe their government because of the war and because of Johnson and so on. So it was very important for Bobby to speak honestly to young people. So he's finally pushed that day to be honest to a point. What he does is a very interesting tightrope walk. He again endorses the Warren Report. He says, I believe the Warren Report, but he then goes on to say, I will open the archives, and the students cheer. So basically he's signaling at that point, without opening up a media firestorm by denouncing the Warren Report, that I will look at the case when I get to the White House.
We have very little time, but you tell an amazing story about how he was hanging around Jackie's townhouse, hoping to be able to engage some Secret Service men to accompany him. Where was he going?
Well, this to me is very poignant. He's Attorney General still at that point, but he can't get his own FBI protection or Secret Service protection because Hoover hates him. So he has to go to his sister-in-law's Secret Service guys and say, can you help me out here? He was going to Dulles Airport, where he met Jimmy Hoffa, his archenemy. I believe he was trying to see whether Jimmy Hoffa knew anything about the assassination.
We want to thank WNYC's Kara McCormick, who was invaluable in tracking down historic clips for today's show as part of an illustration of just where John F. Kennedy really, what he was really thinking about peace and related matters. Some of those ideas have largely been lost, but they are revived in David Talbot's book called Brothers, The Hidden History of the Kennedy Years, which is published by Free Press. And David, I want to thank you very much for being with us today and talking to us about this book. It's fascinating.
Thank you, Leonard. It was a pleasure.
On tomorrow's show, we look into the reasons book review sections are disappearing in so many papers or being slimmed down drastically. Plus, Julie Rossum and Sheila Lukin celebrate the 25th anniversary of their classic Silver Palette cookbook, and Jonathan Cohn with a disturbing account of how the healthcare system is failing Americans across the entire country. By the way, if you've missed something on the show or just want to hear something again, you can listen to archives of past programs at WNYC.org. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blake Neshek. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Angie Sheldon, Tammy Shapiro, Brad Ludlow, and Fran Jacobs. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.